KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I thank you for tuning in today. Today, I'm very excited to have on Henry Chesbrough, Professor Henry Chesbrough of UC Berkeley Haas School of Business, the author of the book Open Innovation, The New Imperative for Creating and Profiting from Technology out of Harvard Business School Press. This is an area of extreme interest to me and also to anyone that's interested in how technology develops, how research and development occurs, and how really new ideas and new processes come to the commercial market and also in the research realm. Innovation is the cornerstone of intellectual property law, the idea that we incentivize the need to create and that we allow people to create by giving them incentives to innovate. And the innovation element is one of the most controversial and most interesting areas that are facing technologists and business people today. The question is, how do you encourage innovation? How does innovation happen? What processes are needed to have innovation, and what processes maybe are not needed or can be changed. Henry has written a fascinating book looking at the flip side of what people traditionally view as the need for innovation. His book, which we will discuss in some detail today on Hearsay Culture, focuses on the idea of open innovation. And I'll allow Henry to define that term more specifically and discuss what it means. But in sum, it's almost turning a lot of the traditional concepts of what we need to innovate on their head. In other words, the idea of sharing information, of leveraging internal and external sources of ideas, are different business methods and relatively new business methods, although not as new as you might think, that are used by more and more businesses today and inventors and technologists to come up with the great technologies that we see today. And Professor Chesbrough's book, and I'll call him Henry unless he asks me to call him Professor Chesbrough, but his book really goes into great detail in a very, very readable way about how businesses have traditionally developed and created and done research and development, but more specifically looking at different specific businesses like Intel and Xerox and others and IBM and how they have looked at what they need to do to encourage innovation. So this topic, while of obviously very, very great importance to businesses and people in commerce, is also of equal interest to anyone that's interested in the inventive spirit and in the ideas and the methods that go into inventing and go into creating new products. I'm very excited to have Henry Chesbrough on today, the author of Open Innovation. I've done my job properly. On the other end of the line is Henry Chesbrough. Henry, are you there?
David, I'm here.
Terrific. Well, thank you for being here today, and thank you for your flexibility as we've been trying to attempt to get this interview scheduled. I want to thank you for spending the time today. Let's jump right in and really just define terms. Open versus closed innovation. Let's talk about the term, and also if you could give the listeners an idea of what led you to do this book.
Sure. David, let me begin by thanking you for having me on the program, and please do call me Henry.
No need
for Professor Chesbrough.
Okay, very good.
The distinction between closed innovation and open innovation is really to help set the context for what's being done today in innovation. And if I could go to the heart of the matter, it begins with asking the question, where is useful knowledge located? And if you ask that question, let's say 100 years ago or so, you would have found that there was actually a fairly sparse knowledge landscape, and that most of the advanced industrial knowledge that was needed for innovation was actually located in a very small number of organizations who created these newfangled organizations called research and development laboratories.
Mm-hmm.
Most people think the first ones started in the German chemicals industry in the 19th century, and DuPont brought that model over to the U.S., along with Thomas Edison and a few others that really in the early 20th century got the early U.S. industrial labs going. Meanwhile, in the universities in that era, most degrees in universities were either in theology or the classics or the humanities. Engineering was not even considered to be a valid field of study at some of the liberal arts institutions. And this is one reason why institutions like Caltech and MIT were started, is that the traditional universities were pretty slow to pick up on engineering as a topic of valid academic inquiry. So that it took some years to get those legitimized in the universities. So 100 years ago, there wasn't much useful industrial knowledge in the university. So at that time, if you wanted to innovate, and you needed to have a tremendous amount of knowledge to do this, you typically had to go out and start your own R&D system in a company and go out and hire people to do the long-term activities to create and then develop and then manufacture and distribute new products and new services. Today, if you look 100 years later, it's a very different industrial landscape. Useful knowledge is distributed all over the place, not only in the United States, but really all over the world. And that means that the innovation process can start in a very different way and can operate in a different way. Today, no one has all the useful knowledge inside their own four walls. No matter how good you are, no matter how much money you've spent, there's much more knowledge available on the outside. And so what makes sense today is this more open process that's more distributed, builds upon each other's activities in trying to get new ideas into the marketplace.
When we talk, when we use the term open, how fair is it to say that it's an analogy for lack of control?
It is the case that open is about influence as opposed to control.
Mm-hmm.
There are areas where you have some ability, particularly what I describe as the business model, which we may talk about in a few minutes, where you do not only create value, but you have some place where you can capture some piece of the value. But there's no question that in the value creation part, it's much more about influencing than it is about control.
The business model is something that I do want to get into to set the stage for the listeners. And I guess I can ask the question this way. When we talk about open innovation, we're talking about something that is relatively new in thinking in terms of how businesses have done R&D. What I'd like to know, if as you can describe these two models, is how far along have we come from the traditional models of the term that you use of closed innovation?
Well, that's a good question. I think that the progress that we've made varies by the industry that you look at. If you consider the entertainment industry, for example, in Hollywood, back in the days of the studio system, that was a closed innovation model where the director, the lead actors, the production studio, the distribution network in terms of the movie theaters were all under the control of a single organization. Today, of course, that's been completely blown apart. And there are producers that round up these projects. They recruit directors. They recruit actors. They recruit sound effects people, catering services. They distribute all through all kinds of different channels of distribution, and everybody has an agent. So in that industry, they're quite far along, I would say, in this open approach. By contrast, if you looked at nuclear power generation, I think they're still fairly closed in their approach. There aren't that many useful places around the world that know a lot about how to manage nuclear power facilities and how to engineer new ones, which is probably a good thing, but it does vary, I think, by industry.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the antecedents to this idea, the history of innovation. And your book does a fascinating job, I think, of talking about this what you call the closed innovation paradigm. I had on the show Anne Finkbeiner, who wrote the book The Jasons, about the group of scientists that have done work for the Department of Defense. And one of the things that I discussed with her was something that you also touch on in your book, and I'd want to get your reaction to it. The scientists have traditionally had this dichotomy between the applied or practical uses and the traditional or theoretical uses. And you look at some of the works of scientists and how scientists were used both in the academic sector but also in the business sector, and talk about the idea, at least in the past, that anyone that was, and to quote your book on page 22, at least of the paperback version, that U.S. scientists regard the pursuit of practical knowledge as, quote, prostituted science, unquote.
Right,
and
right.
And it's a fascinating debate among, it's not, and this is a debate, of course, that occurs not just in science, but also in law and other kinds of professions that straddle this line between what people traditionally call the calling and more of a service. So I'm curious to get your reaction. You talk about that view as being an older view, perhaps a snobbish view. I'm curious to get your sense of where we are today in terms of the role of scientists in innovation and whether that traditional view of the prostituted science still exists.
Boy, that's a wonderful one. I should start by acknowledging that I'm quoting on page 22 the work of another academic, a gentleman named David Hounshell.
Right, I should have pointed that out. You're right.
Carnegie Mellon University. Mm-hmm. And so he's a wonderful business historian who has written at length and quite eloquently on these topics. And so I'm actually standing on his shoulders with that particular remark. In terms of what's going on today, I think that outside of the life sciences, we live in a world today where most money for academic research does not come from the government. It actually comes from industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not the case 30, 40 years ago. We had Sputnik in 1958 and 59. That led to this massive infusion of federal spending in research and development, much of which went to the university campus and really fueled this enormous expansion of R&D on campus. But that's really played itself out now, again, except in the life sciences, where the National Institutes of Health is still quite strong. So in most fields now, most academics have had to make their peace with industry in some form, if only to get funding for their research. Maybe one best example of that would be to look at Stanford University itself,
mm-hmm.
where now the president of Stanford University is John Hennessy, who himself is a founder of startup companies and still sits on the board of certain startup companies. So far from seeing industry as prostituted science, Hennessy himself has been there and has actually been bringing university research and industrial practice closer and closer together.
Hmm. Is it, you know, it's an interesting area, and I've taken a look in my own research on the role of government scientists in patenting and early congressional hearings on the scope of patent. And I found some very interesting comments that I just kind of want to get your reaction to. One comment that this is a government scientist who was being asked about whether he felt that patents were appropriate for government scientists. And his remark, and I'm paraphrasing, but effectively was that it would be a perversion of my role to accept any kind of commodification or any kind of financial benefit for my work because of the nature of my employ. And I'm curious your reaction to that in light of the fact that as you mentioned, that scientists are playing these various roles, from purely commercial to purely theoretical. Is that a view which you think at this point is largely antiquated, or is there a place for that kind of person in the innovative scheme?
Oh, well, there's certainly a place for someone who, as you say, feels the calling. And I think every academic scientist is motivated by more than money. So I don't mean to suggest that the universities are now crawling with mercenaries seeking to sell their knowledge to the highest bidder at all costs.
Right, and in fact, hearsay culture is a Creative Commons device, so this is going out for free.
Yes. So I think there are at least two currencies in academia. One, of course, is money, but the other one, and maybe the more important one, is reputation. Here at UC Berkeley, for example, if you look at the middle of campus, where we have a terrible, terrible parking problem, maybe even worse than Stanford, right in the middle of campus, you'll see a separate parking spot for NL, which stands for Nobel Laureate, which tells you that this is something that the university recognizes as one of the highest things possible, and what we give them is the most scarce resource we have, which is great parking right in the middle of campus.
Mm-hmm.
not because of the money they make, but because of their scientific achievements.
Right.
And the Nobel Prize itself, I think, is clearly built not on your industry impact. It's clearly built on your fundamental contributions to fundamental advancement of knowledge.
Being that we're both affiliated with universities, I do want to focus a little bit on the role of universities in research and development. As universities have partnered with businesses, and as they work together in tandem with businesses to both do their own research and also to, for various reasons, work with businesses to develop what they're working on, how has it changed the research that universities have conducted?
I was just going to throw in one other piece of information to the previous question, and then let's turn ourselves to the impact on research here in the U.S., and that is, I've been over in Europe recently a number of times, and one of the things that's common in the United Kingdom, in Northern Europe, the Scandinavian countries, has been a real concern about what they call the gap between academic research output and then industrial innovation. The problem as they define it is that there is very good science being done in these countries, but the translation of that science into actual industrial output seems to be lagging. And the industrial R&D spending and the take-up of university research seems to be too slow in their judgment in these countries, hence the concern about the gap. Even the Lisbon Agenda that was defined in the year 2000 to make Europe the world's leading knowledge economy was predicated on boosting countries' R&D spending to a higher percentage of gross national product. One of the things we've actually achieved in the U.S. is a much more rapid take-up of academic research into industry. And so some of the conversational elements we're having, I suspect, are byproducts of our approach that I think does pose some ethical dilemmas. It does create potential conflicts of interest. And to your question, I'm going to talk about next, there's a question of does it corrupt the science or prostitute the science? The good news is I think it's helping to accelerate the transition from academy into industry, and that's actually probably helping our economy.
Is the let's talk about some of those ethical issues, because I think they're fascinating. What do you see as the major quandary that a university employed scientist faces when entering into these partnerships?
Well, I think one quandary is the university. Let's sort of start from the beginning and work our way forward. I think there are different conflicts as you go forward. The earliest conflicts, I think, are the university scientist has knowledge that they've learned through some research and experiments and whatnot. And if they write these down in their notebooks, they will become the property of the university. If they choose not to document them and write them down, there's some possibility that they could pursue this outside the university, especially if they have these insights not while they're at work, but if they're at home on the weekend or in the evening or on vacation somewhere. And they aren't using university property and so forth. So there's a very interesting ethical question about who owns this knowledge at the early stages of its creation. And the scientists actually have some discretion about this. There are, of course, professional norms about this, but there are also going to be some personal motivations. Now, as you work forward, if the let's suppose that the professor declares this knowledge to the university and files it in some kind of a discovery or invention disclosure with the university, then there are the questions, okay, what happens to this disclosure? Does it go out to industry? Universities typically will only patent if they have somebody willing to pay the costs of patenting because they don't have the money to go chase each one of these on their own. So the professor could influence whether somebody's interested or not, and how much do they do there. Once the patenting is being pursued, how much time does the professor spend helping to get the patent written? Meanwhile, there's all this question about publication. Should this professor be doing a paper or giving a talk at a conference? And does he do that talk before the patent is filed, or does he wait till after the patent is filed? All these questions come into play as well. So there are a lot of very interesting ethical questions, even at the early stages of knowledge creation.
Do you get the sense that the open innovation model, or let me put it another way, does the open innovation model help answer some of those questions for the university researcher? In other words, the one of the traditions of science, of course, is the sharing of knowledge and the publication of research discoveries. And in traditional models of controlling the intellectual property of a particular organization, that would be difficult to do. Do you think that the open innovation model spurs or helps solve some of those quandaries for the scientists?
Well, yes and no. To take the no part first, in the closed innovation model, the assumption was the heavy lifting was all going to be done in a big industrial research laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that work would be the property of the corporation funding that research. And sometimes that worked well. Other times the corporation would sit on this research for years or even decades before it would see the light of day. In the open innovation model, it's messier at the outset because it's less clear exactly who owns what at the outset. And it's also likely that the knowledge that you need is going to be distributed in many places rather than a single large laboratory. So there's going to be a task of rounding up and knitting together the different pieces from the outside. But at the same time, I think the take-up rate and the potential number of parties that know about it and might make use of it is much greater than that single organization. So I think that it doesn't have as long a dwell time in the lab waiting to get outside. I think there is a faster take-up in this open innovation model because it can go in many different directions.
This kind of brings us into kind of another major area, obviously, that you discuss in your book, which is what you call leveraging multiple paths to the market. And there are certain obvious ones. Obviously, technology and the ability to share information is clearly on the table. I'm curious if you could give me a broad overview of just really at the top level what those new paths to market are that exist today that didn't exist, say, 15 or 20 years ago.
Yes, I would say one of the big ones that has really become much more prevalent in the last 20 years has been licensing. Now, licensing has been around for a long time, but I think we're seeing it at different volumes of transaction activity now that are much higher than they used to be 20 or 30 years ago. So a lot of people are doing a lot more licensing with their stuff than they used to use.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one path. Another that you'll see more of these days are these collaborative joint ventures, startup companies, and technology spin-off companies that come out of universities or out of large research labs. And this has really grown in conjunction with the expansion of the venture capital industry, which has really feeds on these kinds of this feedstock of ideas, and helps give them capital to commercialize them.
Hmm.
Venture capital doesn't pay for research. Venture capital only pays for development. So it really requires that there be a repository of research ideas that are primed to be developed, because they're not in the business of funding the basic research, the discovery-oriented stuff. They're all about the commercialization activity.
We're going to have a music break in a few minutes, and I want to, at that time, turn to intellectual property, something that I focus on and something that is a focus of your book. But I do want to, you raise an interesting point about venture capitalists, and I kind of want to get your perspective on them. They're another group of people that in many circles are vilified. They're necessary, obviously, for funding. They have interests that really are it's suggested in the name, which there's nothing wrong with from the standpoint of anyone that needs to put food on the table and earn a living. And yet venture capitalists also, I think, are sometimes viewed as being people who have interests that are rather narrow. And I'm curious to know whether the role of, again, getting back to your idea of open innovation and of reconfiguring a business's thoughts about how they capitalize in the market, where the venture capitalist fits into that schema.
Yes. One of the challenges of openness, and I think one of its virtues, is that no one entity has all the answers. And in a much more open innovation domain, you get the benefit of many eyes with many different agendas looking at the problem. let's say there's a new technology, and the question is, what do we do with this, and how best to put it to use? In a single large company, they're going to try to put it to use in their current business. And sometimes that may work great, but other times that may not be the best way to use the technology, and there's a long history of technologies created where the ultimate best use was not the originally envisioned use. What venture capital brings to the game is that it isn't just a monolithic single firm. There are actually a whole, thousands now of these partnerships, all very small. Even the largest venture capital firms are 20 or 30 people tops. So it's a lot of very, very small organizations who all have different looks at the same problem, and they all see it in different perspectives. They all have different histories of what they've funded that works, and they have different beliefs about what's going to be important in the next 5 or 10 years. And because of that diversity of beliefs and experience, you get a much richer evaluation of the technology, and I would argue you get a better ultimate outcome because of it.
I think your book is fascinating for the main reason for me is that it's full of what are ultimately, for a lot of people, counterfactuals. That in fact there are ways to do things that a lot of people have written off. We're going to take a short music break, but when we return from the break with Henry Chesbrough, the author of the book Open Innovation, A New Imperative for Creating and Profiting from Technology, I want to talk about intellectual property and also delve a little bit into some of the examples that you use, including the example of Intel and the work that they've done. Before we return to the show, I want to do what I always do at the bottom of the hour and ask you for money. So here's the begging. If you love what you're listening to right now, please help KZSU maintain its excellent programming. KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that depends on the support of its listeners to continue broadcasting its diverse range of music shows, sporting events, news, and talk shows. By visiting kzsu.stanford.edu and clicking on Donate to KZSU or emailing underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, you can do your part to make sure our independent sound and innovative programming, using the word of the day, doesn't die. So we're back here with Henry Chesbrough. And Henry, let's talk a little bit about the intellectual property schema that we're in today. So you make the suggestion, or I don't want to characterize it, but really let's kind of just delve in this way. Do we need strong intellectual property rights to incentivize innovation, in your view?
Yes, up to a point.
Okay.
I think that there was an experiment done in the country, I think it was Holland, at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, where for about a 20-year period, they actually abolished patents entirely in the country. And it was something of a natural experiment about what would happen if you got rid of patents. And I think the feeling of the people who studied that period, at least some accounts that I've read, was that it wasn't a positive experience because people would go elsewhere to patent their inventions and innovation essentially bled out of the country to other places. So unless we could abolish patents, in a very widespread, nearly universal way, that experience I think would suggest we wouldn't want to. I think more positively, for young companies, particularly startup companies, we were talking about venture capital a few minutes ago, they need a certain amount of intellectual property protection to get their financing and to attract capital and begin to build out and scale what they're trying to do before the big companies come in and start trying to copy or imitate what they're doing. It's still, I think, in most cases, most startup companies don't succeed, and that's probably as it should be. But at least having some amount of IP strength gives them some chance to go make it. And I think our whole economy works better with those small companies goading the rest of the economy to move faster, even if they don't succeed themselves. So now, having said that, if you go too far, you can actually foreclose entire areas of innovative activity because nobody's going to invest in that area if they think it's all going to be collected by one or some small group of people who are going to corner the market, so to speak, because of their IP rights. So I think you have to find some level of patent strength, but not too strong.
It's an interesting idea. Are you suggesting that the market power of the entity that is seeking to control its intellectual property should be a factor in deciding the strength of those rights?
Oh, interesting. Now, I'm not trained as a legal scholar. So
I recognize that.
That sounded like a legal argument to me.
let me rephrase it in a way that is more focused in your particular areas of expertise. And I should have pointed out up front that you're not an attorney. And so I always, whenever I delve into legal issues with non-lawyers, I try to be more careful. So let me put it another way. Is it your experience that the market power of the organization drives its interest in controlling its products?
Yes, I would say that the higher your market share and concentration, you have more ability to exploit more thoroughly the ideas and technologies that you come up with. You also are more threatened by the ideas and technologies that others come up with. So mm-hmm. There's that dual-edged sword, if you will.
Does the idea, and if this is too far afield, by all means tell me. But I'm curious, in discussing your book and your ideas with others, how the idea that intellectual property rights can be changed, even that is very controversial and threatening to a lot of entities. I'm curious to get your sense of how this notion of the book, to the extent you've discussed it, has been received by audiences that you speak to.
Well, actually, this has been an area where there was a lot of comment and a lot of feedback that I got.
Mm-hmm.
So much so, actually, that, David, I've actually just this December brought out a new book called Open Business Models.
Ah.
And it talks directly about intellectual property, about the impact of intellectual property on the company's business model, and shows examples of companies that maybe were too strict and other companies who maybe didn't take enough care of their intellectual property and essentially got expropriated.
Hmm. So this is a book that just that has we're recording this show on December 11th, and so this is a book that's come out in the last few weeks, huh?
It came out December 6th.
Look at that.
Of 2006.
Well, then this is relatively early on the show for me to do it, but now I invite you back. Sight unseen, I invite you back to discuss your book, because that certainly is obviously an area of interest to me as well. Well, I guess what I can do, and I have not obviously seen the book, so I'm at a bit of a handicap, but maybe in light of bringing it up, if you could tell the listeners in a couple of minutes what the focus of that book is and perhaps what your thesis is, that would be great.
Well, one of the things that the second book, Open Business Models, realizes is that if you're going to implement open innovation as a company, you're going to be working with intellectual property, whether you're bringing external ideas into your organization or whether you're letting some of your unused ideas that aren't going anywhere inside, letting those go to the outside. Either coming in or going out, intellectual property figures prominently in your ability to manage that. And that means the relationship of the legal organization to the innovation function becomes much more intertwined and much tighter.
Is the I don't want to go too far into it just because I haven't read it, but I do invite you back. I've asked this of other authors that are not attorneys but deal with legal issues. But I'm curious how has it been, just as an aside, as a business person grappling with all of these law issues, and how what kind of experience have you had with that?
Well, one of the reasons I was encouraged to keep pursuing this area, even though I'm not trained as a legal scholar, is some of the patent attorneys that had a chance to read my first book said this is exactly the kind of thing that our clients need to read and be thinking about when they come and talk to us about their intellectual property needs.
Hmm.
Because the intellectual property needs need to be based upon an overall company strategy embedded in the business model of the company. And that gives a context that serves as a reference point for these decisions of whether to license stuff in, whether to license stuff out, whether to fight things that are going on, whether to enable more open, more commons-oriented cooperative activities as a matter of business strategy. So one fact that I note in the new book is that IBM simultaneously makes hundreds of millions of dollars licensing its patents and has donated more than 500 of its software patents to a nonprofit foundation to support open source software development.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that juxtaposition is really nicely captures this notion in open business models that IP management is really quite nuanced and very subtle. So companies doing seemingly contradictory things like IBM are actually, in my judgment, being quite sophisticated about pursuing a business strategy.
It sounds fascinating, and I look forward to reading the book. One of the companies you focus on in the book Open Innovation is the experience of Intel, and particularly their willingness to publish certain inventions. For the listener's benefit, and by means of an example of the kind of models that you're talking about, can you describe what Intel has done and how it fits into your idea of open innovation?
Yes. Intel competes in an enormously R&D intensive industry, semiconductors. It takes hundreds of millions of dollars of R&D to be a player in this industry. And yet Intel does a lot of its R&D in a surprisingly open way. By that I mean they donate more than $100 million annually to university research activities going on at different university campuses around the world. And they even have created four what they call lablets that exist at Berkeley, the University of Washington, Carnegie Mellon, and Cambridge University in England, where Intel has a group of 30 or 35 of its own people housed in these lablets that actually do cooperative research with faculty at those universities. Hmm. And the lablet is led by a university professor who's on leave from the university to head up the Intel activity. So the university is not going to give exclusive patents on these research activities to Intel. Rather, these are activities intended to be published in the public domain. So why would Intel commit this kind of money and time to activities that are going to be made public, where everybody, including its competitors, can benefit? And I think the answer is it's a very open approach to thinking about this. They benefit, I think, in two primary ways. First is speed to market. Because they're collaborating on this work, they see it much faster than anybody else does. So they know what's coming. They get to, even though they don't own it, if they can work with it and get it to market first, and they can be ahead of others by 6, 12, even 18 months, that additional time to market is worth a great deal of money to them and really makes it worthwhile. The other benefit is that they get leverage. They don't have to invest 100% of the research dollars to generate this knowledge. So that by investing 20, 30, 40 cents of their money, they leverage 30, 40, 60 cents of money from the universities or other companies' donations or the federal government's donations. So they get much more research bang for their buck by giving up exclusive control over the research results.
And the Intel example, of course, stands in stark contrast with the early examples that you discussed, like Bell Labs. And I guess for the listeners' benefit to describe that difference, that would be great. And also, if you could comment on whether the Bell Labs concept is a dead letter today.
Yes, I think many of your listeners will remember Bell Labs, as many do, which is really the very best industrial research lab of the 20th century. I think there are no fewer than 12 Nobel Prizes associated with Bell Laboratories. Hmm. So it was a phenomenally excellent research organization, anchored, we should remember, to a legal monopoly in telecommunications at the time. This is AT&T prior to Judge Green breaking it up back in 1984. So the U.S. telecommunications market can and did wait until the Bell Labs technologies were ready to go into the marketplace. And so it was a marvelous technological group of people anchored to a legal monopoly that could afford the long-term research investments and wait for the results. But in other cases, things had to wait a very long time. And some of the technologies that came out of Bell Laboratories, like Unix, for example, took a long time to get out. Not because they weren't useful, but because they didn't fit well with what the Bell Labs networks needed in business. And it wasn't until the 70s when it migrated into computer science departments and then from there into companies like Sun Microsystems and Hewlett-Packard and others that it really took on an important life of its own outside of Bell Telecommunications.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to add one more example that your listeners will know very well. Being in the Stanford area, and that's the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, or PARC. PARC itself was a phenomenal research laboratory that did really pioneering research in user interface man-machine interactions and was father to many, many breakthroughs in computer science. What people sometimes forget is that it was joined to Xerox's copier and printer businesses, where Xerox, until the early 80s, had near monopoly positions in those product areas. And so technologies like Ethernet or PostScript that came out of PARC didn't fit well with copiers and printers, and Xerox couldn't really figure out how to use them in their own business. The Xerox Star workstation that ended up embodying these technologies in Xerox was sold through Xerox's direct sales force with a Xerox laser printer. Three of these workstations and a printer cost $100,000 in 1982. And you couldn't get a spreadsheet to run on the Xerox Star workstation because Xerox didn't invent one. And they engineered no way for any third party to contribute such a spreadsheet to that product. It had a completely closed architecture. So the IBM PC, which was by, I think, most technical dimensions a vastly inferior architecture, was much more open and allowed third parties to add to it and build upon it. So you saw spreadsheets, you saw database programs, you saw graphics programs, later on desktop publishing, all these other things that weren't possible for the Xerox Star because it had a very closed system.
It's a fascinating comparison, and in fact, the link that you're drawing between research and development and monopoly or monopoly-like power in the market is a fascinating one, something I actually want to give more thought to. I guess the follow-up question to those comparisons is to ask whether the Intel method is transferable to other similar companies or whether it's Intel's specific position that allows it to operate in this more open fashion.
That's a very good question. I think that for many companies, being more open is really the only choice they have because they don't have the scale to do it internally. Intel is big enough today that they could try to do it themselves, but as a matter of philosophy and experience, they prefer not to. For younger companies or smaller companies, let's take AMD, an Intel competitor, for example. Mm-hmm. AMD works very closely with allies like IBM in semiconductors to access technologies that AMD can't afford to do themselves. And I think for most smaller companies, you have to be more open. Now, that means finding allies and collaborating with them. It doesn't necessarily mean working with everyone. In a commons environment, that would be open to all comers. Some of these you might think of as gated communities, where some people are invited in and others are kept out. So I think you're going to see both kinds of collaboration. And when there's really big money involved, like in semiconductor capital equipment, I think those tend to be more like gated communities. But when it's a much lower capital investment, like in software, I think those really lend themselves well to these much more commons-oriented areas.
Is it your goal in the book to create a unified theory of how companies can leverage, as you use it, different avenues to the market? Or are you trying to get the conversation started and get companies thinking in this direction? In other words, what is your ambition for the book?
I think it's more the latter. I don't see this as the last word on innovation, or for that matter, open innovation. I do see it as pointing out a new model of industrial R&D that some companies are already doing, at least pieces of this model, and by calling attention to it and articulating it, I want other companies to think about how they could be more open in what they're doing. And at the same time, to understand what are the new role of universities, of intellectual property, in enabling this kind of a model of innovation.
In the remaining few minutes that we have, I do want to point out another interesting example that you use of companies acting in this fashion is the fact that IBM published some of its own patent applications that would otherwise have been difficult or impossible to access. And that also, in light of the fact that patents – patent law has this publication element to it, is an interesting move. I will save discussion of that issue for another day, because it sounds like it fits very nicely into your new book. I do want to ask in the last few minutes kind of a question that moves and closes us in the direction that you were mentioning about sharing information and having it available to all comers. I take it that it would be fair to say that it is too simple to call your proposal sharing, quote unquote. And this is a social sharing is a topic, as you know, that is being written about more and more, the commons theories, but also, you know, the Yochai Benckler's book, The Wealth of Networks, and others who have talked about how information technology networks allow for increased sharing and what that means for what's created. I take it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that it would be too simple to call your proposal a form of sharing, or would it?
I think you're right. I think it would be too simple to say it's just that. I think, for example, the business dimensions behind sharing are underreported in those accounts.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll indulge me in one anecdote that might kind of get at some of this, one of the thoughts I had was studying open source software as a social movement. And the scholars who have studied social movements, and I'm thinking of one guy in particular named Meyer Zald from the University of Michigan, looked at social movements that have really achieved lasting social change versus those that have not. And the ones that have achieved real lasting social change go through a series of progressions where they outgrow the initial founding team, they outgrow the early cadre of early adherents, they build alliances with other parties and so forth as they achieve real lasting change. And one of the examples he follows is Prohibition, where there was actually a massive social change culminating in a constitutional amendment to prohibit the consumption and production of alcohol. So three-quarters of the states, two-thirds of both houses of Congress, the president, you can imagine, to get all these planets to align took an enormous amount of work. And one of the things that historians have found from studying this social movement is this interesting alliance between what they call the Baptists, who were the people preaching about the evils of alcohol, and the bootleggers.
Hmm.
And the bootleggers were the people who actually had, in my parlance, a business model to profit from the criminalization of production and consumption of alcohol. And it was the bootleggers that funneled the resources to the Baptists to give them the reach to go to all 50 states, get the, I guess it was 48 states back then, get all the amendments passed and get two-thirds of both houses of Congress on board to do it. And what the implication of that for movements like social, like open source, and these sharing technologies is that there are often these interesting alliances that enable these things, where somebody somewhere has got a business model that profits from it if we're going to really drive lasting social change into the enterprise, into industrial capitalism in the United States. And I think if we only look at the Baptists, we miss the bootleggers, and the risk is that the Baptists may get co-opted by the agenda of the bootleggers, and so what they think they're doing in terms of their rhetoric may not match the reality of what is achieved, because we aren't paying attention to the business models that directly profit from these activities.
That's a fascinating point. And I'd love to say, you know what, let's keep going for another hour. And I could, now that you've said that last point, and it's paining me now to say that we're out of time. I want to think about that thought too. Before we go, people that want to learn more about these issues, websites, anything that you suggest, other than your books, of course.
Yes, if you go to www.openinnovation, all one word, .haas, which is HAAS, .berkeley, with three E's, .edu, there's a website there with a bunch of reference materials and listings and more information about open innovation.
Terrific. Well, Professor Henry Chesbrough, author of the book Open Innovation, The New Imperative for Creating and Profiting from Technology, I want to thank you for being on today and for engaging in a fascinating discussion.
David, thank you for having me, and I would love to accept your invitation to come on again sometime.
Wonderful. Then I'm going to be in touch with you very, very soon, and we'll schedule another date sometime in the spring.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. I want to thank Professor Henry Chesbrough, author of the book Open Innovation, for being on today. If he is going to come back, and I looks like he will, which is terrific, then I'll look forward to continuing the discussion with him and examining more closely the intellectual property elements that go into his theories. This has been Hearsay Culture, and my name is Dave Levine, resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. I encourage you to check out CIS's new webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu to learn more about what's going on at CIS. Also, as always, you can find this show as a podcast on iTunes. And also, I'm putting the audio up on CIS's webpage. And I've been a broken record on this, but with my very, very busy schedule the last few months, it's been difficult for me to finalize the webpage, but I do intend to do that. So please stay tuned for more great innovative programming on KZSU. I thank you for listening today, and have a good rest of the day.